Hello, and welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. You're listening to episode number 41. On this week's show, we've got a great new lineup for you. We've got Trevor Current coming in with the news for this last week in the photo industry. We've got a special guest on the show. We've got Nicole Young, Nicole Z, as she's known online. She's well known for her stock photography and for her food photography, as well as being a guest on This Week in Photography. So a little 6 degrees of separation going on there. We're going to talk a lot about stock photography with her too, since she's got quite the extensive background there. All that's coming up right after this, so don't go away. First up on this week's show, we're going to get some news coverage from someone a little more professional than I. I've gotten in touch with a guy by the name of Trevor Current. He does news roundups for a lot of podcasts out there, and he and I have touched base, and he's agreed to provide some news segments for us here at Learning Digital Photography. So I'd like to give some shout-outs and some thanks to him for covering the news. But before we get to the news, a quick shout-out to one of our sponsors, Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken word entertainment, where they provide everything from reading material for books, mysteries, novels, pretty much everything you want. They've got journals, they've got periodicals. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/learn, you can sign up for a free audiobook courtesy of the folks over at audible.com. And now, on to the news with Trevor Current.
Hi, Trevor Current here with a snapshot of this week's photography headlines. We had a few leftover PMA camera announcements this week, starting with Sony's new DSC H55 and DSC TX5 CyberShot cameras. The H55 features a 14.1 megapixel CCD sensor, 25mm wide-angle lens with 10x optical zoom, and a 3-inch LCD. Additional features include Sony's Sweet Panorama technology, optical steady shot image stabilization, smile shutter, and auto modes to make it easy to get the best shot in any lighting situation. The TX5 is the world's thinnest and smallest certified waterproof digital still camera that features a 10.2 megapixel XMOR R CMOS sensor that is also certified to be freeze-proof down to 14 degrees Fahrenheit and shock-proof up to a 5-foot drop. Other features include 25mm wide-angle lens with 4x optical zoom, 3-inch LCD touchscreen display that functions even underwater, sweet panorama, in-camera HDR, and great low-light shooting capabilities. The TX5 is also dustproof, making it a great choice for on-the-go. Both cameras feature 720p HD video recording and a memory slot compatible with both Memory Stick Pro Duo and Class 4 and above SD/SDHC formats. Available in April, the H55 will sell for $250 and the TX5 for $350. A new addition to the active lifestyle category of cameras is the Pentax Optio W90. The W90 is waterproof to 20 feet, shockproof from up to a 4-foot drop, coldproof to sub-freezing temperatures, and dustproof. Designed for that rugged outdoor look, the W90 includes a woven strap with a carabiner to attach it to a backpack and other outdoor gear. Features include a 12.1 megapixel sensor, 28 to 140 millimeter wide angle lens with optical zoom, 2.7 inch LCD with 16:9 widescreen aspect ratio, and digital microscope mode with LED lighting to capture the smallest and closest macro subjects as near as 1 centimeter from the camera. Additional features include iFi wireless SD memory card connectivity, advanced pixel track shake reduction, face detection, smile capture, and autofocus assist lamp. The W90 will shoot 720p HD video at 30 frames per second, and the included HDMI port allows playback on your HD TV. The Pentax W90 will ship in April for $329.95, and an optional waterproof infrared remote control will be available at the same time for $29.95. Pentax also introduced their new MegaZoom digital camera, the X90. It features a 12.1 megapixel sensor, 26 times super telephoto lens that has an equivalent of 26 to 676 millimeters and has a macro mode that focuses to less than 1 inch from the camera. Other features include a 2.7 inch LCD, iFi wireless SD memory card connectivity, HDMI port for photo and video playback, triple shake reduction technology, high-speed continuous shooting up to 11 frames per second, and face detection. The Pentax X90 will ship in April for $399.95. Trek Tech, creators of the TrekPod, has introduced the Essentials, a compact collection of multi-purpose photography and video stabilization tools designed to keep cameras steady without dragging around extra heavy equipment. The Essentials packs a monopod, tripod, hiking staff, tabletop tripod, pan and tilt ball head, and versatile clamping arm into a single compact bag that fits in a carry-on. Check the show notes for more details on the products and a video demonstrating their usage. For a limited time, Trek Tech's The Essentials is only $199.99 when purchased at their online store. SanDisk announced that they began shipping their highest capacity SD card ever, the 64GB SanDisk Ultra SDXC memory card. With its 64GB capacity, up to 15 MB per second read speed, and Class 4 speed rating, the new high-capacity SD card is ideal for capturing and storing massive 1080p high-definition video files and then transferring them quickly to a computer. You can purchase the 64GB SanDisk Ultra SDXC card at SanDisk's website for $349.99, but I'm sure you'll be able to get it much cheaper from other retailers. Professional Photographer magazine awarded Epson with 4 2010 Hot One Awards. The awards represent the photography industry's best and most innovative products for professional applications. The products awarded are the Epson Stylus Pro 3880 printer, Epson Perfection V600 photo scanner, P7000 multimedia photo viewer, and the Artisan 810 all-in-one. Just as a side note, I purchased the Artisan 810 at the end of 2009 and can say it's worthy of the award. Look for my full review in the near future at currentphotographer.com. Lynda.com announced the release of their Lynda.com iPhone app. The app provides access to the award-winning training videos that teach digital photography, graphic design, web and interactive design, business applications, 3D, audio, and much more. The app is free to both Lynda.com members and non-members. Members have access to all 45,000-plus movies in the online training library, and non-members can sample thousands of training tutorials for free. Lynda.com members can log in and see the most recent video they've watched, whether it's been viewed on the iPhone, iPod Touch, or on their computer's web browser. The app features high and low video quality for optimal streaming, whether connected by Wi-Fi, AT&T Edge, or AT&T 3G networks. Check the show notes for a link to view a demo and download the app. That's it for this week. For more detailed information about these stories, go to currentphotographer.com. While you're there, feel free to subscribe to my blog and receive breaking photography news delivered right to your email inbox. If you prefer, subscribe using RSS in your favorite feed reader. Either way, it's fast and it's free. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/TrevorCurrent, and I'll see you next week.
Hello. Back to Learning Digital Photography, and thank you to Trevor for stepping in to take care of the news this week. It was very much appreciated. A lot of good stuff coming out of PMA. With me on the show this week, I'm very happy to introduce Nicole Young. Nicole is probably most well known for her appearances on This Week in Photography, but she is also a really well-established photographer. You're an exclusive photographer for Rightstock, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So you do a lot of commercial work, and you license that out to iStock. So welcome to the show, Nicole. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, since we already had the news covered, we'll just go ahead and dive right in. And I know a lot of the LDP audience is interested in this whole concept, this whole aspect of stock photography. So I figured we could kind of just cut right to the chase here and ask a couple questions. I had a couple come to me via email, And they said, you know, what should we be doing? Because I know she's with iStock, but there's other ones out there. There's Getty, there's Shutterstock, there's Alamy, there's, you know, there's all these different micro stock and stock photography agencies. How do you know, like, how did you, I guess that's the better way to ask it, is how did you know that iStock was going to be the fit for you? What kind of stuff did you look at? What kind of stuff did you take into account as far as the pros and cons of the different stock agencies when you first got into it?
Yeah, that's a pretty good question. I actually started, I'll just kind of go, kind of rewind it a little bit. I started doing this in 2006, summer of 2006, and I actually found out about MicroStock and selling your photos royalty-free through MicroStock agencies in a popular photography magazine. And I was like, well, that's kind of cool. You know, I really wanted to get back into photography because at the time I was actually active duty in the military. I was in the Navy, and I just wanted to find a way that I could kind of enhance my skills. And I was like, well, I could take a class. Or I was like, you know, I found this, and I was like, this is kind of neat. So I did what a lot of people do, and I signed up for maybe like 4 or 5 different MicroStock sites. And, you know, I just was doing it for fun. I didn't actually expect it to grow as much as it has for me. And, you know, I uploaded some photos, and then I started over the few months, I started seeing, you know, one site in particular actually making me some really small amount, maybe like $5 or $10 here or there. But it was iStock. And I was like, you know, iStock, this is pretty cool. And I started getting into the community, into the forums, and I realized that it was more than just selling your photos. There's a lot of other photographers, you know, really active and interacting with each other. And I learned about their exclusivity program. And as I, you know, when I found out about that, I was like, well, this is kind of cool. It seems like it was kind of simplified. And like I said, I was making more money through that site. Yeah. So I decided to slowly, you know, kind of fall off of the other sites. Some of them you kind of get stuck. You know, one of the sites you kind of get stuck into a thing where you have to keep your photos on there for a certain period of time. So as you know, I waited over the few months that I had to. I got all of my photos off the other sites. I went exclusive with iStock when I could because they have certain requirements that you have to meet before you can be exclusive. And they've changed it a little bit now. But so that's really how I got involved in iStock in particular.
Well, you kind of hit on something interesting there. You said you have to meet certain criteria before you can be exclusive, I guess, with any stock company, whether it's iStock or Getty or whoever. Could you also explain for the LDP audience what the difference is? Because I know that's been a question I've always had. Like, I have an iStock account, and I signed up, and I still don't have 10 images approved yet. So for me, getting exclusive on iStock is like many, many, many months away, I think I understand, but the rest of the audience might not be as aware as what the differences are between exclusive arrangements and non-exclusive arrangements with stock photography sites. Could you expand on what that means a little more?
Yeah, sure. Well, the requirements to actually become exclusive, and I hope we get this right because they keep changing it, or they just keep it kind of has evolved over the last couple of years. So it's different from when I was actually, you know, turning all the canister levels and everything and becoming exclusive. But right now, I believe you have to have sold 500 images, so 500 downloads, and or that's going to be soon. They're kind of changing their requirements, but eventually it's going to be 500 downloads.
Okay.
And you have to have a 50% approval rating, which means you have to have at least half of the images you upload have to have been approved for the site, because you get, you know, all of your images have to go through an inspection process. And so if you have at least 50% of them approved, then you can be exclusive. Once you're exclusive, you know, the benefits of being exclusive is, you know, for iStock in particular, I'm not sure how other sites work, if they even have that, but you get a higher percentage of royalty. You know, like I'm at the diamond level, which means I'm at the highest level you can get of as far as royalty amount. I get 40%. Base contributors, you know, meaning they have less than either 250, I think, at the moment, or, you know, eventually be less than 500. I really don't remember how this canister level goes.
Numbers.
You'll only get 20% until you become, I think, bronze level, which I think is like I said, 250 or 500. I can't remember where it's.
Oh, okay. So that's kind of like ski slopes then. The higher up you rank, the better your commission rate, so to speak.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
But if you're not exclusive, you could have sold 1 million photos and still only be getting 20%.
Oh, so the exclusivity
means you get that exclusive.
And does that mean you're only selling through iStock now? Because you said you had to pull stuff off of other sites or something?
Yeah. You're only selling royalty-free images through iStock Photo.
So does that mean, can you still sell your own images then, on your own site? Like, I noticed on your website. Oh, for those of you that don't know, she's Nicole Z can be found over, what is it, NicoleZblog.com? Mm-hmm. Yeah, NicoleZblog.com. She talks a lot about this kind of stuff there. And she talks about the fact that she actually specializes in commercial photography and then licenses the stuff out.
Mm-hmm. I primarily only have sold my photos through iStock Photo. I haven't really branched out to other, I'm officially a Getty contributor.
I'm
approved for their site, but I haven't put anything onto the Getty stuff. It's all royalty free as well, because iStock is a part of, like, I guess the Getty family, is a good
right.
way to put it.
Yeah, I think Getty bought them out, what, like a year and a half ago or something?
I think it was in 2006, early 2006, I believe. It was right before I decided to be start doing it.
Now I'm feeling old. I'm like, God, was it that long ago?
But there's other methods. You know, there's the two main different types of licensing of your images. Is royalty-free, which means, you know, I sell my photo, and I can sell it as many times as it'll buy, you know, as people will buy it, and it can be used. There's not as much limitation to how it can be used and how many times it can be used by that one person. You know, there are some limitations, and you know, iStock offers extended licenses to cover other things, but there's also rights managed, and rights managed is what a lot of the really big companies are going to use, because say you have Pepsi and Coke, and Coke wants to use a certain photo. Well, they want to make sure that Pepsi isn't going to use the exact same photo. So they'll go to like a rights managed site, and they'll purchase that one photo, and then they'll have it'll be managed, you know, like it'll have a certain amount of years they can use it. They'll have maybe exclusivity rights to that photo during that time. So there's, you know, then obviously that's going to cost a lot more.
Right.
So royalty free, and you know, MicroStock in particular is a lot less expensive than traditional rights managed stock photography. And if I wanted to, I could sell my photos rights managed, because, you know, through like any agency I want, or through my own agency if I decided to do something like that, because it's not royalty free.
But it sounds like most MicroStock or stock photography companies would probably be leaning more towards the royalty free side of things rather than the rights managed side of things, just because that's like, I'm thinking of that, what was it? Was it a Time Cover magazine where it was like a $4 download or something from iStock, and they were saying this big old cry out, yeah, this used to go for $10,000. You only got $50 for it. So
the jar of coins on white.
Yeah, that's what it was. The jar of coins. Yeah, yeah. So that, yeah, I'd heard different sides of that argument both ways. One is rights managed. One is more royalty free based. And it sounds like you're leaning more on the royalty free based side of things with iStock.
Yeah, I don't think there is a rights. I don't think there's rights managed MicroStock. I think it's all royalty free. And there might be, you know, some different sites might have different ways of licensing their images, but it's pretty much all royalty free stock.
Cool. Very cool. That's good to know. And it's helpful to know those kinds of differences. We actually had a couple questions come to us through the Twitter feed. I'm not sure I want to read this first one, but Jason Kate, who's one of the regular podcast listeners, wrote in and said, do me a favor, tell Nicole that Nikon called and said they missed
I still have my Nikon D200 for all of you Nikonians out there. I do. I use it. I don't use it for my normal stuff. I use it for like my time lapse photography. I kept a Sigma 10-20 to use so I can get really wide on it. But
so you shoot both? Actually, it sounds like you shoot both Canon.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm mainstream with Nikon anymore. You know, all of my work, my stock and my quote unquote real work is done with my Canon.
And what kind of Canon gear are you using then? Does that mean are you like a 1D Mark II or 1D Mark III? What kind of gear do you
use? I wish. No, actually, I have a 7D, and I love it.
Yeah, I've heard great things about that. I've heard fantastic things about that camera.
I have the 7D. I have a 24-105, and I also have the 200.
Nice.
And, nice. Those are, I mainly use the 24-105. I haven't had it. I've only been shooting Canon since, I guess, October. But
welcome to the fold, I should say then, right? Welcome to the fold. No, we all know, everyone knows these days, it's not really about the camera. It's about who's behind it. That's really what's important.
But, and, you know, it's funny because a friend of mine actually was kind of joking about how you guys should ask me, you know, well, why did I switch, you know? And you know, I was joking because I borrowed his camera for a little while, and it kind of pushed me over the edge, you know? But a lot of the reason I switched was because the type of photography I do is stock photography, and there were just certain things I needed in a camera, and I wanted in a camera, and I was just waiting for Nikon to offer those things, and I just didn't see anything. And I was like, well, maybe if a D700X comes out with more megapixels, and I'm not a megapixel person where I need a lot of megapixels, but with stock and micro stock photography and iStock in general, you know, and specifically,
the bigger the better.
Exactly. You can sell the, if somebody needs a really large file size, they're going to buy it. And if you can't offer it, they might not.
Right.
So it's just nice. And it's also nice to have that wiggle room. Like what if I misfocus just by a little bit, you know, and it's a really big picture. I can compress it down a little bit, you know, to try and sharpen that one little area up a little bit.
Right.
But, you know, so I was just waiting and waiting and waiting, and Nikon just didn't have anything out, and the 7D came out, and I just had this opportunity where, you know, I could buy a camera, and I'm like, I'm just going to buy it. I'm going to do it. And I really actually switched, did a full switch from Nikon to Canon for a lot less than, you know, because I sold some of my gear and I got a little bit of money for my birthday, actually, was in October. So I was, you know, kind of balanced with all that. And yeah, the stars aligned and I got a great camera.
Exactly. And birthdays and Christmases are wonderful opportunities to expand your gear selection.
Yes, exactly.
those are great times to do that kind of thing. That's cool. That's funny. All right. Well, actually, that was it from the listener questions. The other thing I kind of wanted to ask to you, though, being a stock photographer, one of the things I've always wondered is how people light things, because it looks like stock photography is very much different from any other type of photography out there. It's not like it's fine art photography. And yeah, I know you can sell fine art photography through like Redbubble and sites like that, but stock photography doesn't seem to like subjectivity. They like things crisp. They like things sharp. They like things neutral white, you know, just very focused, and it's a very defined space within the photography community. And I'm always seeing things that are pretty smoothly lit throughout. There's not as much creativity in the lighting, and maybe I'm going a little too far in that kind of a generalization. But overall, how would you say you light your work? Do you use like speed lights? Do you use studio strobes? You know, do you go for certain kinds of effects? And if so, what kind of effects do you go for in your work?
Well, it generally depends on what I'm photographing, of course. I've been doing a lot of food photography lately, which I absolutely love to do. And with that, I don't use lights. I use the biggest light that you can possibly use, which is natural light, the sun.
The sun.
Yeah. So I use not, you know, and with that kind of photography, it always looks best if you have natural light or you can mimic natural light, you know. So I just use that with a little bit of reflector. A lot of my work, you know, I mean, if I go back to the beginning of my portfolio, a lot of it was just with reflectors. It was just outdoors with reflectors. And, you know, mostly when I was photographing people.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say everything else is either speed lights, which I'm kind of not using as much as I'm using strobes. I have Alien Beast strobes with softboxes. And when, you know, like you said, you know, lighting for stock photography is kind of quote unquote boring, and it is. But you know, the whole point of it is to make it look like it looks in real life. You know,
right.
that can be actually kind of challenging sometimes. But you don't want it to look like it was lit. You know, if you're doing a scene of, you know, a patient and a doctor, you know, you want it to look like it's just normal, natural. Doesn't have to be flat and real boring light, but just like if you don't have lights on the people, like it's the light overhead or something, you know.
Right.
So that's really, you know, and that's the stuff that's really going to sell.
That brings up a great question, actually.
Yeah,
and that brings up a great question, because you were talking about doing some people photography and like a person in a doctor's office and how that's the stuff that sells, because it does seem like stock photography, because I had always had this vision of stock photography as being like a screw, you know, mm-hmm. and a coffee mug. You know, and then a mouse and a keyboard. And I'm looking at my desk right now in case you can't tell. You know, a drobo, a monitor, a cable modem, you know, those kinds of things. And stock photography is real, it seems like it's more than just product photography. It's also about people photography and getting them in natural settings, because that's what, I guess you have to think of it from a business perspective. What do business people want to do to sell their products? They can take pictures of their own products, so they want pictures of things that are not their products, which means people in natural, real-world kind of settings. Is that an accurate perspective from, it seems like, what's going on iStock these days?
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people do different things, but I know, like, I prefer to try and find natural people doing, let me kind of take a step backwards. A lot of people, and even, you know, when I started doing stock photography, I would take a picture of anything I could find, you know, or anything that I could light. And, you know, I'd take pictures of maybe models on Model Mayhem. I had a lot of people asking me if I could do stuff for their portfolio in exchange. And so we kind of swap model release for photos. And so I have a lot of just kind of portrait stuff in my portfolio. But as, you know, as I progressed and I learned, I'm like, you know, to really actually do this and make money doing it, you have to make an effort and actually create a photo, not just, you know, I mean, I have some grab shots. I have some really great stuff that sells. That was just like, you know, like one of my best selling photos is a little girl with a sunflower. It's my best friend, one of my best friend's little girl and some of my favorite little models in the whole world. And I was like going to her house and I had my camera and I was like, oh, let me, you know, I went to the grocery store. I was like, oh, these are really pretty sunflowers. Bought the sunflowers, brought them over, took some pictures, and, you know, I've made a lot of money on just a couple pictures. Just,
next thing you know.
Yeah, so that can happen. And those are kind of just like the happy accidents of, you know, stock
sales.
But I'd say the people who really, really make money doing this, who make big money doing this, they hire models, they find locations, you know. Sometimes they have makeup artists. They have other people helping them, you know. I mean, there's, you know, and these are even just one-man shows, you know, not necessarily like the Yuri Arkers who have like a team of people doing a lot of this stuff for them, you know.
Right.
I do all this stuff by myself, and, you know, other people that I know that do it, they do it all by themselves. And either way is great. If I had a team of people, it'd be awesome too. But
never turn down free help. There you go.
To really, really find, you know, to, you know, like I said, there's a lot of avenues to be successful in microstock. But the way that I see of being really successful is to create your images, and it costs more money to do that.
Right.
And it takes a lot more time. But ultimately, you know, like the money I'm spending today and the work I'm putting in today in 6 months to a year is when I'm going to see a return.
Right.
So, you know, anything I was doing 6 months to a year ago is what I'm making money on today. So it's a long, you know, evolution
Okay. No, that's good to know. It's good to know. You said it's about a 6 month lead time there.
Yeah, probably at least. And I haven't done, you know, the real math on it, but that's generally what I see.
That's interesting. You know, okay, well, that kind of brings up an interesting point, because if someone is thinking, hey, I've got some great shots from Christmas, maybe I should put them on iStock, that's probably not going to be something to put on iStock until around June.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. You know, you really have to think ahead. You know, I'm probably more aware of holidays and seasons because I'm doing this, and knowing that, you know, like, for example, Easter's coming up. So there's a lot of people who now, or maybe even a month ago, have been or should have been doing their Easter photographs and uploading them, you know, to sell in the month or two before Easter, when all the designers are going and finding their photos to use for Easter.
That's a great tip. That's a fantastic tip. So if you're interested in getting into stock photography, when it comes to seasonal kinds of things, you want to be shooting those seasonal shots, it sounds like 3 to 6 months ahead of the actual event itself. That's good to know. Very good to know. Very cool. Very cool. Well, we had a couple of listener questions. If you have some time and you want to stick around to answer a few of them, that probably would be interesting for the listeners as well. They hear me all the time, so why not bring someone else
into
the mix? We had a couple questions come in. One guy, this guy Nick from Charlotte. Actually, hey, this might be a good question for you too. He writes – oh, wait, that wasn't Nick. That was Candace. Let me read Candace's question first. Candace wrote in from St. Louis. She sent me an email and asked what kind of lights are best to use for product photography versus studio photography. And I'm not sure what she's asking there, because I always thought product photography was kind of in the studio. I think she's maybe talking about product photography versus portrait photography, if I'm interpreting her question right. Candace, if I interpreted your question wrong, feel free to email me back or chime in on the podcast. But it sounds like she's going for product versus person, people type of photography. And since stock photography can be a combination of both, that might be something worth mentioning from your perspective. When you're shooting people versus, I don't know, a screw or a Jobo or whatever kind of product, do you light things differently depending on what you're shooting? I guess that's kind of a no-brainer. But do you do things different? Like how do you do it different?
Well, I'm not an expert in product photography. I do the food photography, and it's a type of product photography, but it's not using, like, you know, finding angles to, you know, get rid of shadows and, you know, reflections and stuff like. But I would say, you know, there's some things you'd probably use in portrait photography that you wouldn't use in, you know, product. Maybe, you know, like in portrait photography, what I use now, I would be using soft boxes, and, you know, maybe some reflection. There's, you know, the modifiers as far as, you know, the alien bees with the soft boxes. I would say you probably wouldn't use a beauty dish in product photography. You know, I'm sure there's ways to do it, but I think it's really that's challenging. That's a really difficult type of photography to do, because there's a lot of light sculpting depending on your photograph. If it's something like a metal pan or something, you know, that you have
to Yeah, how would you? I don't even know how to do that.
Yeah, I don't either. But I would say any. I don't think that there's really any difference with the equipment you would use, but, you know, as far as where you'd put the lights, there's going to be some difference. You're going to want to have probably, you know, you're going to have a key light, a fill light, a, you know, maybe even some kind of rim light or something, but
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a challenging question, too, because we could probably spend our whole podcast show talking about just how to light different kinds of subjects. Yeah. And, you know, people photography, it depends on what kind of a setting they're in. Are you talking about getting a glamour shot, or are you talking about, like you said earlier, someone sitting at a doctor's office? You know, it and I hate to give this answer, but I always give this answer, it depends.
It does.
Which it really does, unfortunately.
If they're asking the kind of light, you know, you can get, if you use strobes, which I don't use monolights, I prefer to use, you know, the strobes as opposed to the whatever, the lighting, I guess. I don't like using, because they get really hot. But I would say the answer is they're both the same.
Yeah.
If you have a set of lights you use for portraits, you can probably use the same set of lights for products.
My answer to that question, I think my answer to that question is go to strobist.com.
Oh, yeah, that's a good source.
There's a great site there run by a guy named David Hobby, strobiz.com. Very useful. He's got a lighting 101, a lighting 201. There's lots of resources out there that can go into really nitty-gritty details about how to light different kinds of things and, you know, how to modify light, like you were saying, talking about snoots and grid spots and beauty dishes and all that kind of stuff. David Hobby's site, strobiz.com, is an excellent, excellent resource. And it's a good question, Ken. Just don't get me wrong. Thank you for writing in. I do appreciate it. And hopefully we gave you at least a little bit of a hint, because it does kind of depend. The lights don't really change, like Nicolzy was saying, but the modifiers will change and how you position them would change. So thank you, Candace, for writing in with that question. The other question that came in is from Nick in Charlotte, and he wrote in asking, what is the best way to make sure my photos are color accurate? Did you want to chime in on this one first, too, Nicole? Or you want to go first?
Oh, I can chime in. I would say, well, okay. Here, if I'm not sure what he's talking about, if his question is for printing or for web, but either way, my recommendation, and this is for anyone, I say everyone out there who's listening to this podcast, go buy a
all six of you
a calibrator. Go buy a calibrator, and you don't have. I have probably one of the cheapest ones you can get. It's like a Spider Express. It's probably only $100 or something like that.
Yep.
It's just going to basically calibrate your monitor. So you're seeing, like, if you calibrated your monitor, I calibrate my monitor. So whoever out there calibrates a monitor, we're seeing the same thing. I mean, it may be off by like a tiny smidgen, you know, but it's gonna help you. Because if your monitor was tending to be on the magenta side, you might not notice it until you edit your photos, and then you look at a different monitor that's calibrated, and it's going to be like too green because you overcompensated for the color, you know, that was wrong on your computer. So exactly. I would say just go out there, buy a calibrator. Doesn't have to be an expensive one. If you want to do any kind of, if you want to try and print from your computer to your printer, then you get into a little bit more pricey calibration systems, and, you know, trying to make sure your printer's seeing the same thing that your computer's seeing, and so on and so forth. But
right.
I found that anytime I like print anything through, say, MPix or any type of printing site, even Costco, you know, I've printed a few things from there.
Nothing wrong with Costco. They got some great deals, man. I love MPix to the cows come home. I do my metallic prints from MPix, and they rock. But, you know, if you got to just get some 4x6s done from the family get-together, hey, Costco's
all the way.
5 cents a print. Cha-ching.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
The color is actually pretty good. You know, like, if you calibrate your monitor, and it's going to be really close. So that's my answer. Calibrate. Do you have anything?
Yeah. I think that's a great point about calibrating your monitor. It's all about the color workflow and working within a controlled color space. If you're not corrected from the get-go, it doesn't matter from that point on, because if you're not color accurate from the very, to use his phrase, if you're not color accurate from the beginning, it doesn't matter what happens downstream. It doesn't matter whether you're porting it to the web, or porting it to a print, or porting it to your retailer, whether it's Costco or MPix or anything like that. You have to get it right on your own computer first, and the only way to get it right is to make sure that your monitor is correctly, like you said, calibrated. You said you have the Spider Express?
Yeah, I have an old Spider Express.
But
it still works.
Yeah, it still works. I guess the only thing I would add to that, because I have the Great Tag Macbeth X-Rite one that I use for my monitor, and really regardless of the calibrator that you use, or the colorimeter, I think. It sounds like a Martian thing.
Yeah.
I'll fry you with my colorimeter modulator or whatever. But, you know, as long as you use that and you do it regularly, because especially with LCD monitors, the color will drift on those periodically. So it's not like you can just set it and forget it and you're done. You never have to do it again. Because the color will drift, especially with the LCDs, because they heat up and the color can change slightly. So you want to do it on a regular basis. I have my schedule set to once a month. People who are really particular about it will use daylight balance lights in their house, and they'll measure the ambient light. And you can take it to the nth degree. You know, you can get really specific and go to nitty-gritty details. But Nicole's absolutely right. You know, if you want color accurate, you got to start with the calibrated monitor. Spider makes some good ones. Great Tech Macbeth from X-Rite makes some good ones. There's a whole bunch of options out there. Google calibrator, and you'll see any one of a number of options that are available. So, okay, thank you, Nicole, for answering that. That was a great answer. Thank you, Nick, for the question. Our last one, and they requested that their email remain anonymous, which is the first time I've seen this, but they're asking what kind of videos stock companies are looking for from content producers. And this one I actually am going to have to defer to Nicole for, because I don't shoot a lot of stock, hardly any at all. So I guess there's two questions here. First off, Nicole, do you do any video type work for iStock, or do you stick strictly to still photography?
Well, I do have I have two videos on iStock, and they're both pretty much just when I went to Photoshop World in Vegas just last fall, and I set my tripod. I'm out to have a tripod. I don't know how I set my camera up, but I just did like a really completely out of focus cars going down the street. And I think it was with a lens maybe completely wide open with no aperture inside of it. So it was like F0 or 1.0. I don't know what it was.
F0.1.
It's really kind of cool. Yeah. F0.1. It was and so it's just like lights moving. You know, it's just like street. It's kind of artsy, but it's kind of
cool.
It can work really well for stock. I don't do a lot of video, so it's
Let's kind of switch the question up a little bit. Instead of videos your stock companies are looking for from content producers, we kind of hit on it a little bit from the still photography perspective, because you said people or stock photography companies look more for people type photography rather than image products. I'm sorry. Go ahead and expand on that.
Everybody's looking for everything. You know, there's people out there looking for, maybe product stuff, maybe, you know, random stuff, maybe landscape stuff, action, sports. But what I've found that works for me, the stuff that I enjoy photographing people, and I enjoy photographing food. So those are the two things that I stick with. And fortunately, they also are things that sell. When people ask, you know, what kind of stuff sells, I can't give like this sells and this sells and this sells. You know, you can't give like a solid answer. So for people to go out and just take those pictures and then they'll sell.
Right.
It's not magic like that. But what I say is, you know, pay attention to TV commercials. When you look through a magazine, pay attention to like the, the ads and stuff.
Sure.
And just kind of absorb information in like, you know, styles and what you see. A lot of the stuff you see is stock photography, and that's what people are buying, and that's what people are looking for. And, you know, of course, you don't want to copy, but be inspired by that stuff. You know, I'll watch a TV commercial, and I recently actually did it was a food photo, actually. It was a photo of I made bruschetta, and then I had these crazy out-of-focus lights in the background that were really big. It made it look kind of like it was, like, outdoors, you know, nighttime kind of look. And I was inspired because I'd seen – so I think it was a Macaroni Grill commercial. And it wasn't even the same food. It wasn't the same at all. But I was like, hey, that's kind of cool, you know. And this light bulb went over my head. I was like, I got an idea for that. I can make that into something. And it's kind of fortunate for me. I don't have a DVR. I don't have good cable. So I have to watch commercials when I watch TV. And it actually – you know, inspires a lot of photo ideas, you know, just, you know, from watching video, something that goes by in video, and they go, wow, you know, that could be a cool, you know, I got an idea for that now. So
I would say
just pay attention. You know, whenever I want to do any kind of food, I'll get food magazines, or I'll get a cookbook, and I'll look through and colors and styles and placement and styling and all that kind of stuff for the food stuff I do. And, you know, you just get inspired by looking at other things and also knowing what, you know, somebody bought that or somebody commissioned that to be created.
Right.
So other people might be looking for the same thing.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, actually, that kind of leads to one last question that I have for you. I have to admit that I invited Nicole Zion not only for the listening audience, because I had questions for her too. So this kind of leads to one other question, because a lot of this is focusing on people photography, and you made a reference to Model Mayhem earlier. So do you actually go out and get models to pose for you in different scenarios, or do you just like get family and friends to pose? And then if so, regardless of the scenario, my biggest question is, how do you make that transition from just having fun and taking some pictures to actually getting them to sign off on a model release, because I know these stock photography companies require model releases. Mm-hmm. You have to have a model release signed off on. If it's a minor, you need to have the parents sign off on it. And like, I took pictures of our next door neighbor's kid. They had an adorable daughter, and I have hundreds of pictures of her when we got together for dinner one night, and I just did not feel comfortable asking them to sign off on a model release. It seems like that'd be a tough thing to do with family and friends. How do you approach that? How do you make people comfortable with it? I guess you have to be comfortable with it, number one, but then how do you make them comfortable with it, number two?
Well, I've never had a bad experience, with as far as selling photos with a model release and have anything like that. So, I know some people they see what the business model is of iStock and how those their image, their likeness could be sold on, put anywhere on a billboard or whatever. But I usually, when I talk to people, a lot of people, I explain what I do. I explain how it works. And I'm like, photos can be used on advertising. This is where I sell them and so on and so forth. I've even had my photograph taken and put on iStock, and people have bought it. I don't know a lot of the photos that I have some photos of my dad in there, friends, summer models. I don't go to Model Mayhem as much anymore. I find that, and it's every model is different. I've had one really good experience with a model. She went in commercial stuff, so it worked really well for my purposes. But a lot of the models on Model Mayhem want a lot of more fashion-y kind of pictures, and that stuff, for me, it doesn't really sell as well from what I'm looking at. The kind of pictures I'm going to take, people aren't going to want to put in their portfolio. It's like, look at me, I've got a headset on and I'm at a computer. It doesn't really, they don't really want that.
That's not a glamour shot, that's for sure. Yeah. Doesn't have the bling going on. Look at this classy plastic headset. It has no logo. Cha-ching.
No logos. There's another thing. But, right now I have a friend. There's a couple, and they are they're pregnant. So they know what I do. And, we talked about it. And so they know that as soon as they have their baby, they're going to get baby photos for free because we've made the agreement. And I'll do trades sometimes. I'll also pay models if it's, especially like the commercial stuff that they use for anyway. So, I don't know. I guess it's most everyone I have approached has been okay with signing a release, I'm very honest about what I do and what happened, where the photos can go, and I'll show even examples of how some of my photos have been used, and so it's hard. It takes practice, I think. It takes just a little bit of confidence of going up to someone, and I know somebody who will approach strangers on the street, and a lot of times we'll get a model release and have them sign it, and I don't usually do that. I usually make some kind of relationship with the person, and actually know them before I have to ask them to sign anything. So
yeah, it might be a good idea to know them a little bit. But yeah, you're right. There's some people that just have a certain flair for it. You can walk up to a stranger on the street, like you said, and within a few minutes have a model release, and I'd be like drawing a line in the sand with my toes saying, well, I don't know, do you want to sign this or not? I think you have to have some kind of self-confidence, be confident in your own skills and your own abilities and present yourself positively. And that probably would be a great way. There's so many questions. And the stock photography industry has always had kind of this aura about it. Like, this is a stock photographer and this is what you have to do to get in. And like I said before, I'm still trying to find my 10 best images to get approved into the stock photography scene. So it seems like there are some barriers to it that requires you to reach a certain level of proficiency repeatedly, repeatable results, and that's what they always talk about, a professional photographer. A professional photographer is someone that can repeat results on a consistent basis, and that does seem to be the case with stock photography as well, not just with portrait photography or product photography, but being consistent across the board. And like you said, that 50% approval rating, that seems to weigh into things as well there. So,
yeah, I would say that the moment I started treating it like a real business and a real job was mm-hmm. when I started to really see a lot more income and success, really.
Right.
So.
Right. Very cool.
I treat it like that. You like to take, I have all these old photos on my computer, which is common. And, I thought the same thing, too, when I first started. A lot of people think, I have a lot of photos on my computer. I can just put them on iStock and they'll sell. Well, they still have to go through an approval process, and it's a big learning curve when you get on iStock. And I actually have a lot of thanks towards iStock and the inspectors because my photography is very close to being technically perfect. Now, of course, it's not. I always I still get rejections and I still make mistakes, but I am so much better. I'm a much better photographer now than when I, you know, than 4 years ago when I started doing all this.
Right.
And so it was a good, you know, it served the purpose that I wanted it to. I wanted to become a better photographer and take more pictures, and now it's my full-time job. So
that's very cool. Yeah, that's awesome. And I guess I'm still working my way up that curve because I haven't quite gotten there yet. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Nicole. I know we're getting late on time. We said half an hour, and I'm looking at my little Skype clock here, and it says 37. I'm like, oh, crap. I promised to have her off in half an hour. So my apologies for keeping you long, but I do appreciate you staying on and helping me take the listener questions and answers, as well as talking about the stock photography field in general. I know it's opened a lot of eyes for the listenership and for myself as well, so it's been very educational. I do appreciate you taking the time to stop in. Where can people find you? I mentioned your blog earlier. You're at NicoleZBlog.com.
Yep, it's NicoleSYBlog.com, so people know how to spell it.
Right, NicoleSY. Yeah. And I always say NicoleZ because I hear what the guys say. So I was
that's how I say it.
Very cool. And do you do the social media? I know the answer to this, but the other people probably don't know. so where can people find you in the social world? Their Twitters is, was it Ron Brinkman? Does he say that? He's on the
Twitter. I don't know. Twitters, probably.
Twitterverse.
I'm on the Twitters. I'm NicoleZ on the Twitters.
NicoleZ on Twitter. Okay.
It really, if you went into Google and just type NicoleZ in, you would probably find me.
Yeah, there aren't many NicoleZs out there.
There's the one, somebody out there has NicoleZ.com, and one of these days,
ooh,
I'm going to get it. I'm crossing fingers that it should send me back an email. I know, but I'm NicoleZ pretty much everywhere but that. So.
Right. So, okay, well, now we're going to have to pull up NicoleZ.com, and people are going to start hitting the site, and they're going to be like, where'd all this traffic come from? Go to NicoleZBlog.com.
NicoleZBlog.com.
Do not click on NicoleZ.com. Wrong website. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on. This is the end of the show, so I'll give my contact info here as well. It's jason@canonblogger.com. The podcast will be published at Learning Digital Photography over with the folks at Personal Life Media. Nicole, again, thank you for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun having you. Thank you to all the listeners for stopping in to listen to the show, and we'll see you next time here at Learning Digital Photography. Thanks, Nicole.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jason.
Bye now.
Bye.